So I'm going to start with a very quick overview of some sample code for RPCs and RMIs, okay, which may be useful for your project. And then what we are going to do is talk a little bit about stream communication, and I'll start a new topic on naming today. Okay. So I presume all of you have at least taken a look at the first programming assignment, and hopefully have gotten some start on it already. Just to give you a sense of how RPCs work, I got a small piece of sample code which I will show you. Okay, so basically, as I had said maybe two or three classes ago, when you write an RPC program, what you have to do is you have to write basically a spec in an ideal interface definition language that you will run through the RPC compiler, and that compiler will automatically generate the stubs for you. Okay, and then you write the client part of the program, the server part of the program, and you link in the stubs, and then you get a client binary and a server binary. Okay, so what is actually shown here, so this .x file is essentially the spec you write in an IDL for the RPC gen compiler. So I don't know if you can see this in the back, but what is being shown here is basically a definition of a program. Okay. This is basically a very simple user lookup program. So you can look up a user by username, and the program will return you a numeric ID for the user, or you can look up the user by their ID and it will give you the name. Okay, so there's a table with usernames and IDs. You look up on one field, it gives you the other, and vice versa. So there are two functions here. So there's a by name function and by number function. In the by name function, you just pass a string, which is a username, as an argument, and returns you an int, which is the ID. And by num, you pass the ID, which is an integer, it returns the username. This is basically what you will specify to the IDL. Okay. This number here is basically a number that reflects the ID of the program itself. Okay. There's a version number that you define, which is typically 1 for the first version of your spec. Okay. So that's the spec. And then you use this RPC gen. So that's the RPC gen compiler there. So let me just show you that there is basically, right now I have three files. I have the spec, I have the client program, and the server program. Okay. So what you will do is you will run this through RPC gen, and then it will generate all of these files for you. Okay. So there is that XDR file that it generated, which is basically responsible for the XDR conversion. So you will see that all of this is C code that it has generated. So here is basically the XDR program that it has generated. So it has all these things in there. And then the more interesting part of this is the client stub, which is, so this is the client stub. You don't really have to know what it is doing, but you will see that in there it is doing a client call to bind to the server, for instance. Okay, this is what you will, it will use to connect to the server and set up the TCP connection and whatnot. Okay. And then once it, so it does that, and it sends the arguments and the username and whatnot. So here is the client call that it is actually using. This is the name of the function you are calling. That's the argument that you are passing, and so on. So all of this is sent as part of the message. Okay. This is done by the stub. You don't write this. As you said, the RPC compiler actually generated all of this code for you. What you do write are the client and the server program. So let's start looking at what the server program would do. So the server program has to implement these two functions, lookup by name and lookup by ID. And this is basically what it sees. So this is the lookup by name part of the server. So those are all the arguments. It basically processes the argument and returns a result. That's all it is doing. Okay? And the other function is lookup by number. And it is also doing the same thing. It is basically, you get the argument, it does a lookup, okay, and then the lookup is actually here, and then local lookup, and then it is going to return the username. This is all you write on the server side. Yeah, there's no main, nothing. These are the two functions. They just look like C functions. And the stub actually has the main program that is going to call all of this. I'll show you the server stub that the RPC compiler has generated for you. So this is the server stub. You'll see that it actually has somewhere in there, or it should have rather. So here is the main that was automatically generated. So it will get linked with your program and it will be the thing that is going to accept calls from the server. So it, you see that all the socket code is automatically generated. So this is get sock name and whatnot for you. Okay, so you don't need to understand all of this, but it is the thing that is generating this. And here are the two, not this one, but so this is the stub for the function that you just wrote at the server end. So this is the thing that is actually going to call the function you wrote. So the main will call this. This is going to unpack the argument and call your actual function. Okay, so you will have one for each of the functions. So what you will essentially have to do is you will do something like GCC. You will take the server stub, you will take the XDR code, and you will take the actual code you wrote, and you will link all of those three things together, and that will give you the server binary. Okay. For the client binary, you have to take the, again, the XDR code, the client stub, and the client code, compile it together, you get the client binary. Okay. And then all of the code, once you run the client and the server, they can talk to one another. Just if you want, I can put up something like this on the web page if any of you are interested in looking at sample codes and whatnot. Okay. That should give you some flavor for RPCs. For RMIs, there is a lot of documentation on the Sun's Java web page. Okay. And the example I'll show you is directly taken from there, so I didn't download it, I'm just going to show it here. And then I'll also point you to the documentation on what to do or how to use it. So this is a RMI program that just computes the value of pi. There's a client that makes a request to the server returns the value of pi for it. Okay? So there are all these files that you have to write. And they are mostly very simple. As you will see, here is compute.java. Just two lines. It just defines the interface. Okay. Saying this is the interface for the compute task. So you're going to write this compute object which will accept a remote method. So it's very simple. You just say this is the interface for this object and it can throw exceptions and whatnot. This is the actual code that you're going to write, okay, in Java. So here is your compute engine that implements the compute interface that I just showed you in the previous file. Okay, so this is basically a public thing, anyone can call it, and then there is some code. Okay, so this is the main thing in there. All this is doing is it's basically computing the value of pi, and what you see is it starts a new engine, okay, and then it basically does a unicast remote object. Okay, it is going to actually register itself with the registry. Okay, so you remember, there is a registry, the server has to register itself. So this is the piece of code that is going to do, first you get a registry and then you bind to the registry. So there's this rebind call. You're registering yourself with the registry. Okay? So that's the engine that you write. So this is the actual compute pi class. So, at the client end. So, this is basically again going to do a lookup on the registry. You'll see that there's a registry.lookup. So, on the server end, you bound to the registry, or you do a lookup saying where is the server process running, and then you just make the call. So, here is what you do, compute.execute task. So, you ask it to execute the task, it returns the value of pi to you. Okay, very simple. And then there is, so this is at the client end is defining the interface again. So this is again a one line thing that just says this is the task interface for the client. So similar concepts here in the Java world. And the way you actually go about compiling this is also very similar. So if you go into the tutorial itself, you will see the process is very simple. So compiling, you just use the standard compilers. Okay. So you can use Java C to create a jar. Okay. As is shown here. Depends on whether you use Windows or Linux. It's, the syntax is similar but slightly different in both cases. And in the to run it, you will have to first start the registry. Okay, so you start the registry itself. Okay, and then you will have to run the server and the client programs. Okay, so this is, I believe, running the server. So you call Java and call the server program. And then somewhere there is how do you start the client program. So just as you would start any other Java program, you would do this. So if, but the only important additional step is you have to make sure the registry is running, which is a separate process. If you don't have it, then when the server tries to bind itself or the client tries to do a lookup, it's going to fail. Okay? For RPCs, you don't have to do that because the RPC directory service is a Unix daemon that will be started on the fly for you. Okay. Case of Java, you have to start it explicitly. So the RPC world is called RPC port mapper. Here it's called an RMI registry. So RPC port mapper is a process that's either running in the background already or will be started if you start an RPC program automatically for you by the system. Here you have to start one. Okay, so that's basically what it is. And there is a lot more information on the tutorial on the Java documentation pages. I can put a link to all of this on the course webpage. Okay. So with that background, let me just pause to see if there are any questions about the project itself. Okay. Anyone has any questions about what needs to be done, how you need to go about implementing it? Okay. So next week, what we can do is actually have maybe an extra office hour session. If you have specific questions, you can come ask. Because the project is going to be due the week after next. Okay, so bulk of the work you probably have to put in next week. So as you start writing your assignment, if questions come up, we can try to make ourselves available. Okay, so with that quick background, let me go back to the class. Okay. So if you remember last time we were talking about audio and video streaming, we started discussing stream communication, and basically the important aspect that you have to keep in mind for stream communication, specifically audio and video communication, is data is isochronous, which means that there is a playout instant that is assigned to each piece of data. It could be an audio sample or a video frame. And in the case of streaming, the server has to make sure that each of these pieces of data get to the client before the deadline. Okay? Now, that said, the network itself, the way things are implemented in the internet and using TCP/IP, does not give any guarantees on when data will arrive at the destination. Okay? As I had also mentioned, there are research proposals that people had developed to see how you can add this notion of a guarantee on either the end-to-end delay or guarantee on the loss or the jitter into the network so that this becomes a network service. Okay? None of those have been implemented, but we'll at least look at some basic concepts on this notion of quality of service. Quality of service essentially refers to what are the guarantees you need on the stream from the network. Okay? In order for this application to function well from a user perspective. Okay, so this is called quality of service, or QoS in short. Okay, so typical quality of service parameters may look like the bitrate at which you want to send this data. Okay, the bandwidth that the network allocates to you has to be at least equal to the bitrate. You're sending, let's say, 200 kilobits per second stream, and you only get 50 kilobits per second bandwidth, either it's going to take a long time for you to actually get enough data to start playing it out, or if you start playback, you're going to get these glitches because data is not coming at a rate that equals the stream playback rate. Okay. So that's for the the simplest quality of service parameter you want. There are many others. You want a bound on the end-to-end delay. If certain packets take a very long time to arrive, okay, they may arrive after their playback duration, playback instant, you will again see playback delay. But if you bound the end-to-end delay and you employ a buffer at the client, then you can ensure that there will not be any problems with the playback. You also want some bound on what is called a jitter. Jitter is the variation in the delay that you see. Okay. So there's the delay itself, but if the delay keeps fluctuating, you might have to have more buffer at the client in order to absorb this fluctuation. Because some packets come quickly, others take longer. So that implies that the client has to be smarter about how it plays the data out. Okay. And you may want bound on the round trip time if there's interaction going on between the client and the server or new notions of interact. So this table actually specifies some other parameters. Okay. So the thing that I did not, so this is what the client would specify, that this is the data rate at which you're sending, and we'll talk about what this token bucket means in the transmission rate. But the service that you also want is you want some bound on the amount of loss. Okay, if you're sending this as a UDP stream, then some data may get lost because the UDP does not guarantee you that there will not be any loss in any packets that are sent may get dropped at intermediate routers if there are congestion. Okay? So you may want to bound the amount of loss because if data is lost, typically in case of streaming data, there's no time to retransmit it. Okay? Because by the time you know that the data has got lost and you retransmit, the playout duration has already passed. So getting old data and you have actually played past that point in the stream is useless to it. Okay. So retransmissions typically don't work unless you have a lag between the time data is arriving and time you have played it out. Okay. If you are using TCP, then TCP is actually giving you retransmissions, but it may or may not be useful, as I just mentioned. Okay. So there may be things like the loss interval. We'll see what this means in just a moment. Bounds on the delay you see, bound on the jitter, which is the variation in the delay, and so on. Yeah. So you may want to specify these parameters or want to get these guarantees from the network. Okay. Now question is how this may be a fairly complex specification. So what I'm going to show is a much simpler way to maybe specify what you want from the network and how you go about enforcing it inside the network. Okay. So this is what is referred to as a token bucket specification. Okay. Concept is actually shown in this picture, and I'll mention why this is called a token bucket. Okay. Now, if you actually look at the way you encode streaming audio or streaming video, although there may be an average rate at which you are able to encode this video, typically there will be some fluctuations in the bit rate. Okay. And the fluctuation arises from how complex, so in case of video, it depends on how complex the stream is, or rather the scene is. Okay. So if the scene has high complexity or high degree of motion, so let's suppose you have a, so video is basically a sequence of images that you are playing out at a certain rate. Okay. So depending on what is in each image, okay, the amount of bits it takes you to encode that image can vary from one image to another. Although the size of the image is the same, the number of pixels, okay, so this could be 640 by 480. Okay, 640 pixels, rather 640 this way. So you could have a 640 by 480 pixel video. This is NTSC quality, the same quality you see on your TV screen. Yeah, HD quality or high definition involves more pixels. But so if it's 640 by 480, each image is going to have the same number of pixels. Okay? But data is typically compressed using MPEG or JPEG or some compression algorithm, and the number of bits it takes you to encode this video and compress it will vary from image to image. And this depends on the complexity of the scene. If there's a lot of objects in the video, there's a lot of change of texture or lots of colors, it will take you more bits to encode that information. Okay. If this is a video, let's say, of just a blue sky and all the pixels are blue or just some shades of blue, not a whole lot of texture, that information can be compressed in much less, fewer bits. Okay. So what this says is the number of bits that is present in the video stream will fluctuate from one image to another. Okay. So that also says that the rate at which you are sending will also keep changing depending on which image you are sending over the network. It is not a constant rate. So this is referred to as variable bit rate streams or VBR streams. Okay. Audio typically does not necessarily have this characteristic. Audio may be what is called constant bitrate or CBR. Okay. The bitrate is more or less fixed. Okay. You have some number of bits per sample. Okay. Then you use the same number of bits per sample, and that's the rate at which you encode your audio stream. Now, if you have variable bitrate streams where the bitrate is fluctuating, there may be an average bitrate, 100 kilobits per second, but the actual rate is fluctuating around 100. Some frames take more and some frames take less. So the way you go about specifying what the stream requirements are is in terms of what is called a token bucket. Okay, this has two parameters, as is shown there, a rate and a burst. Okay, there's a rate parameter R and a burst parameter B. Together, these two specifications sort of capture the fluctuations in the stream. So the rate R refers to the average rate at which you are going to send data, you know, to the or the network. Okay? And the burst B captures the maximum fluctuation you expect to see around this average rate. Okay, so that sort of bounds the maximum fluctuation that you are going to impose on the network. Okay? And the reason this is called a token bucket is this rate, this specification can be captured using this notion of a leaky bucket. It is also referred to as a leaky bucket. So think of this as a bucket with some number of tokens. Okay? And in particular, the depth of the bucket tells you how many tokens can be included in the bucket. Okay? That's basically the burst parameter B. So if you have a token bucket with burst parameter B, let's assume there are B tokens in the bucket. Okay? And tokens are leaking out of this bucket at a steady rate R. Okay. So each packet you need to send into the network has to get hold of a token, and then it gets to enter into the network. If the bucket is empty and you want to send a packet, you have to wait until the next token is generated. Tokens are generated at a rate R and they enter the bucket. Okay. Since the depth of the bucket is B, you can never have more than B tokens in the bucket at any given time. If the bucket is full, you're generating more tokens, you throw them away. Okay, is this clear what I just said? So this is think of it as an abstract bucket with some number of tokens. Tokens are generated at a rate R. The depth of the bucket captures how many tokens can be in the bucket, the maximum number. Okay. And what this token bucket is doing, it is regulating the rate at which you are injecting packets into the network. Now, the rule is every time you send a packet, so this is the application, these things are packets. Every time you send a packet into the network, you have to grab a token from the bucket. If there is one already, you get to go instantaneously. The bucket is empty, then you have to wait until the next token is generated. And since you are generating at a rate R, you will have to at least wait for 1 over R milliseconds, for instance. Okay. Now the question is, what is the characteristic of the stream that you are going to send into the network if it is regulated using this token bucket? Typically there is no regulator. You can send at arbitrary rates. Your OS is not going to police or force you to send at certain rate. But if you put this into the OS, then the OS is actually going to enforce a rate at which you are allowed to send. You cannot send at any rate that is greater than what this token bucket is going to allow you. Okay, so let's see what this is giving us. So what's the average rate at which you can send packets into the network? How many packets per second can you send? R, because you're generating at a steady rate R, you can actually send at this rate. Okay, but because there is a B tokens are actually stored into this in this bucket, you can instantaneously send at a rate greater than R. In particular, if the bucket is full, you can send up to B packets all at once, okay, which will cause you to exceed the rate R. Okay, is this clear? So this is basically the burst. So you can send a burst of packets, but once you send this burst, your bucket is empty. From at this point on, you will not be able to send at the rate greater than R because you just emptied your bucket. Okay. But you can send at a rate lower than R, in which case the bucket will start filling up again. This is how you can actually go above or below your rate, but the token bucket will enforce that you will never be able to, on an average over some long period of time, send at a rate greater than R. Okay? So the particular property that you are enforcing is over any interval T1, T2. Let's say this interval T1, T2 is this is the difference between, this is the length of the interval. So, for any interval T1, T2, the amount, number of packets you can inject into the network is always bounded by this quantity. Okay, this is the rate at which you are generating token, this is the length of that interval. So, you can send this many packets plus an additional B packets. Okay, over any arbitrary interval T1, T2. That's what that token bucket is enforcing. Okay, is this clear? This question. Oh, repeat the last one. Yes. So, basically, the what I'm trying to see is what is the form of the stream that you're sending into the network in terms of its bit rate. So, the point I'm trying to make is over any time interval T1, T2. Okay. How many packets can you send into the network? What's the maximum bound on the number of packets you can send? The maximum bound is T2 minus T1, that's the length of the interval times R, okay, plus B. Okay, the bound is how many tokens are you going to generate in that much interval. That's the bound on the number of packets you can send. The number of tokens you can generate is the steady rate R times the length of the interval, and if you start with the full bucket, then you have B buckets, B tokens. Okay. So you can never send more than these packets. So this is a bound on the number of packets you can send. So, if you actually draw this as a figure, you can think of this line, this is time, okay, this is bits or packets, okay. This is the y-intercept is B, the slope is R, okay. So this is basically y equal to B times T plus R times T plus, that's the slope of this. So R is the slope of the line, B is the y-intercept. This is the token bucket is enforcing that the number of packets you have sent into the network will always be under this curve. Okay? So you can be anywhere under. You could actually track that line or you can go up and down, but you will never be able to exceed this curve because you will never have more than that many tokens. Okay? So that is how you are regulating the rate at which you are sending data into the network. Is this clear? So what you have to do in order to use this is take your video stream and characterize it. Okay, you will have an average rate, but because I said the scene complexity keeps changing, the bit rate of individual frames will keep changing. So you have to then characterize what is the burst that you are going to see. If there is a complex scene where the rate actually goes above the mean rate, what is the maximum complexity you have seen in this video file? That will tell you the burst parameter. Okay. The average rate of encoding tells you the mean parameter R. And then you can say that this video stream basically has this characteristic. Average rate R and the maximum burst B. Okay. If you have a token bucket that actually enforces that spec, then you will be guaranteed that you can send all of the data on time without having to hold anything back. Okay. There's a question, yes. Burst is... So, the question is burst a parameter of the token bucket and the video file? Typically, it's a parameter of the token bucket. The token bucket itself is capturing the characteristics of the stream you want to send into the network. Okay? So, to ask for the right token bucket and allow you to send the data out, you have to first characterize the stream and see what's the maximum burst you see in the stream. Okay? And then you say, in order to send the stream out and ensure that data gets to the client on time, I need a token bucket of this spec. So you tell the OS, can you give me a token bucket with rate R and burst B? The OS says, yes, I have enough resources, I have enough bandwidth to do this. It will give you that token bucket. And then you start sending the data. The token bucket is merely checking that when you are sending, you are not going to exceed anything you said you would have exceeded, which is you will never send at a rate greater than R and burst B. Okay, that's how it will work. So, in some sense, there is both the characterizing the stream as well as enforcing at runtime that what you are sending is actually going to conform to what characteristics you specify. Okay, so, in that sense, it applies to both. Okay, so, now think of what you can do with the burst. So, in particular, if you set the burst to 1, what does this mean? You will always send at a constant rate R. You can never fluctuate. Okay. Or put another way, you can never basically, you can always send less than R, okay, if you want, but you will never be able to send, if you are actually sending at R, you can never exceed that rate. Okay. But if you have an arbitrarily large burst B, for some small period of time, that burst allows you to exceed R. Okay, in other words, whenever B is greater than 1, you can temporarily exceed R until you have used up your burst. At that point, you are again sort of forced to go back to R or lower. Okay, so by picking the right parameters, you can control how much variability in the stream you are allowing, or how if you don't want, then you will set the burst parameter to 1, then you have to send at a constant rate, or no more variability than what is allowed by a constant rate stream. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so I did not actually mention a lot of these other details. So what will happen if you have a system like this is, if you want to send a video stream, you have to a priori characterize that stream and then ask the system or the network saying, I want to send this variable bit rate stream, and here is the average rate at which I am going to send, here is a burst parameter. And then what the network will have to do is see, does it have enough resources within the network to accommodate this stream? Does it have enough bandwidth, which is rate R? Okay. And does it have enough capacity to accommodate this burst to ensure that none of the buffers at the router will overflow? So when you send a burst, so you will have queuing in the network. We are sending a whole number of packets all at once. Okay. If you don't have enough buffering capacity in your intermediate routers, then those routers will have to drop that packet. Okay. And what that means is the network does not actually have the capacity to accommodate this burst. So in that case, you will not be able to guarantee to the application that you can send a stream and data will arrive at the other end without any problems. So if the network has sufficient capacity, then you say yes, and then you enforce that token bucket at the sending end. And then you send at that rate, and then OS just checks that you are doing what you said, and the network will guarantee you that quality of service. Now, as I said, this is not what actually happens in practice. None of these mechanisms are actually implemented in any routers or networks. These were proposals, there were prototype networks built, but today's internet or TCP/IP doesn't do any of this. What you have to basically rely on is that the network somehow has enough capacity to give you the quality you want. Many cases you have that capacity and you don't see problem, but many often if the network is congested, you don't get this service level from the network, and then you see all these glitches. Your playback YouTube videos freezes because data is not coming at a rate that is required to play this video out at a smooth rate. Okay. So in other words, this is actually going to give you some guarantees on how the network behaves. Today's networks don't provide any guarantee. They are called best effort networks. They do the best they can, but no guarantees. Okay. If you don't get what you want at that point, then that's too bad. So that's what this is saying. So there I'll show you some examples of what might happen if you do not get the right quality of service. So what this figure is showing are three things. The top row is actually showing you the rate at which the server is injecting packets into the network. Here we have assumed for simplicity that this is a constant bit rate video. You're basically generating packets at a constant rate, there's no variation. There's a rate R, B set to 1. So you are basically, so packets are equally spaced, they are of same size. So you are sending at a steady rate into the network. And this is how the packets are actually arriving at the client end. And they are arriving, basically you will see that now there is some packets have longer gaps and others have less. And this is because there may be queuing at the router, so you will not see packets arriving at the other end at the same steady rate you sent. Sometimes packet arrive closely spaced, sometimes there is more spacing. And this is how you are actually playing out. So what the last line is showing you is how data is playing out. So what the client has done is, although playback from the server started at this end, it waited for some data to arrive. So it's employing client-side buffering. So in particular here, you wait until the first 6 packets arrive and they are all in your buffer, and then you start playing things out. So long as you don't have buffer underflow, you will continue to see steady playback. If your buffer empties and no more data has arrived, then you will see playback glitch. So in particular, what has happened here is now you are playing at the steady rate, the same rate at which you are sending, and you have 6 packets buffered. So you basically played the first 4 packets, and then the 7th one arrived. So now you only have 3 packets in the buffer. So you played 5, 6, 7. Yeah, you emptied the buffer at this point. No other data has arrived. So there is a glitch. So then the 8th packet arrives. At this point, what the client will typically do is not start playback, although here you show that. It will start wait until some more data is arrived, build up the buffer again. So you will see messages like buffering and whatnot in your video player. That's essentially what's happening. Your buffer has emptied, there's no data to play, so it stopped playback, it's waiting for some more data to arrive, and then it will resume playback. None of this will actually happen if the network actually provides you the quality that you asked for. If there were some guarantees, then this would not have happened. Data would have actually arrived before the playback instant, so you keep playing. Okay, but because it's a best effort network, you see problems like this. Okay. So here is another technique. So that was what is called jitter in the playback, because there is variable amounts of delay that the network is imposing. Although you are sending at a steady rate, data is arriving with different end-to-end delay, so you have this jitter. So that causes problem. The other cause of problem is packets are actually lost. Okay. You send a packet, it never arrives. So that's another problem that can arise if you are using UDP streaming. So here is an example. Okay, so you are sending data as is shown on the top. So here we are, let's assume that each packet can take more than one sample. Okay, if this is an audio file, this is probably true. So the first packet has 4 audio samples, and the next packet has 8, another 4, and so on. Okay. And then first 2 packets arrive, but the third one is lost. Okay. Now you have basically this gap of samples. You can play up to 8, and the next thing that's going to arrive is packet number 13. Okay. There's no time to retransmit. Yeah, because by you are playing at a real-time rate, by the time that data has actually come back, you would have gone forward into the playout stream. So you will basically just see this gap, either video playback or audio sample. Okay. And that is not pleasing from a user experience perspective. You keep seeing these gaps where you basically the video freezes and resumes at some other point because that data never arrived. That's not a pleasant viewing experience. So here's one way to mitigate this effect. Okay. And what this is doing is it's scrambling data. Okay, rather than sending them in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you're actually scrambling. You're taking the first sample from each of those packets and sending. So you send 1, 5, 9, 3, then you take the second one, 2, 6, 10, 14, and you send that, and you take 3, 7, 11, 15, and send that, and so on. Okay. So now if the same third packet gets lost, the losses actually get spread out in your stream. Okay. And the claim is this is somewhat same amount of data has been lost. Right? Four samples or 4 frames have been lost. But now they are actually spread. Here there is a sort of 4 consecutive ones got lost. Here there are sort of they are spread. Okay. And the claim is this is somehow better from a user experience perspective than that. Why would that be true? Yes. True. So I'm not showing that you can actually you can only start playback here. That is absolutely true. Otherwise, you cannot start playback here because 2 hasn't arrived until that point. So this has shifted the increased playback latency. No question. Okay. So that is a given. When you scramble this, there is more waiting before you can start the first playout. Okay. But assume that you are willing to tolerate that. Instead of waiting 1 second, you waited 4 seconds. No problem. Okay. But then data is still lost, and the the claim is this will actually give you better playout experience. Why? Yeah. So as is being pointed out, the reason this is better is if you have small glitches, it is not perceptible to the human eye. Because video is being played at either 10, 20, 30 frames a second, there are 30 images going by every second. If in 1 second you play 29 instead of 30, this won't be perceptible. Okay, because data is going by so fast that you cannot actually perceive the difference between 29 frames that were played out in a second and 30 frames. But what is perceptible if is there is a longer gap. Okay. If 10 consecutive frames are dropped, you will perceive this. Especially in audio, it becomes even more perceptible because that basically involves a silence period. Okay? So if you spread the losses out, that's always better. So for the same loss rate, scrambling the order in which you send data allows you to give better user experience without doing anything more. Okay, except as was pointed out, there's just a longer delay where the first playout can start, because you need 1, 2, 3 and 4 all to have arrived, for instance, before you start it. Yeah, but beyond that additional delay, this gives you better experience. Any questions? So this is one way by which you can address loss. Yeah, the better way is, of course, if the network guaranteed there was no loss. But assuming that there is going to be loss, this is one way you can deal with it.
Yeah. But if you have a live broadcast and stuff, this won't be a much possible, right? Because the sender is sending in order.
Right. The sender is sending in order. So this requires more intelligence at both the client and the server. Right. The server is sending data in scrambled order. The client has to de-scramble before it can play it out. So if that intelligence is not embedded either in the client or the server, this will not work. But there are techniques that actually do that. There are protocols that will do all of this for you. By default, it is not going to be done. So there's another thing that's mentioned here. You can use forward error correction. Because retransmissions don't work well for streams, one way to recover from losses, so this still has losses, we don't recover from it, is if you send a little bit of redundant information. And this is called forward error correction. So if you send this redundant information, then you can actually recover small losses. Okay, you can't recover a long gap of losses, but you can recover small losses. So for instance, what you could do is you could take 4 packets, compute an XOR of that 4th packet and do a 5th packet, because this could be equivalent of what's called a parity packet. So you send 5 packets. If one of them is lost, you can use the other 3 and the parity to recover that lost packet. Okay. And this is basically you're sending more redundant bits, so you can tolerate losses. Okay. Now this will increase the bit rate of your stream by 1 nth, depending on how many n packets you use to generate this redundant packet. But this increased bandwidth is offset by the ability to recover from some small number of losses. Yeah, these techniques are referred to as forward error correction, or FEC. We will not look at them in detail here. I just wanted to mention that's a potential way by which you can further reduce the impact of any losses, in addition to doing things like scrambling. Because there are couple more slides on issues that I want to mention, and then we will wrap up here. Okay. So there's this issue of stream synchronization, which is also important. So typically, if you take any file, okay, it has multiple components. The simplest two are audio and video. Okay, when you call, say, your video file, you really mean the video and any audio that is embedded in it. Okay. So what happens is you are essentially getting not one, or logically it looks like there is one connection, but you are getting two independent streams, a video stream and an audio stream over a network. Okay. And from a playback perspective, you want to ensure that the playback of these two streams are synchronized. Okay, to ensure that you are lip sync, that whenever you see somebody talking, you want the corresponding audio to be played out. Okay, if they are not lip sync, then you have again this user quality problem where you see an image but the corresponding words are not being played out at the same time. Okay. So to ensure lip syncing, you have to ensure what's called stream synchronization. Okay. And here is a picture that will make this clear. Okay. So here you are assuming that there are two streams, a video stream and an audio stream. The audio stream is being played out on the speaker. The video stream is being rendered on your monitor. Okay. And the playout of these two have to get synchronized. Now, in the event that these are coming to you as two independent streams, two independent sockets, okay, you have a bigger problem of synchronization. Typically, when you have things like an MPEG file, the audio and the video are actually embedded in the same file. And so if you get data, you get the audio and the corresponding video both at once. Okay. But that need not be the case. You may actually get them as two separate streams. Okay. And then it is the task of the client at the application end to synchronize them to ensure playback is lip synced. Okay. The way this is typically done is that you have a common timestamp and you timestamp each packet, okay, on the audio, and you use the same clock to timestamp both. And the timestamp tells the client what is the time at which each of these have to be played out. Okay, if an audio frame and a video, video frame and an audio sample have the same timestamp, that tells the client that they have to be played out at the same time. Okay. So by putting timestamps on the packets, when you generated these streams, the client can know when to play them out, yeah, and ensure synchronization. Okay, otherwise you will basically get out of sync very quickly, and you can only be out of sync by maybe 100, 200 milliseconds, and you can start perceiving that things are not lip sync. So even small amounts of sort of this synchronization issues can cause problems. So this is another issue you have to deal with when you do streaming of audio and video over a network. Okay, is that clear? So this is basically all we have here. So I'm now going to go back to a new topic on naming. Okay. So we will not be able to complete this today because we only have a half hour left, but let me start off by this. So what does naming mean? Okay. Typically what names mean is, if you have any resources in your system, from a perspective of an application or perspective of the end user, you give it a name that is easy for you to understand or access that resource. So files and file names are the simplest example. As far as your system is concerned, a file is basically a container of bits. It's just some data you have stored. The system doesn't care what you name it. The naming is only important from your perspective, so that you can go and access this file at a later point by providing the right name to the system. The project1.java tells you that this file contains code for that you have written for this project. Right? If a system is concerned, you could have named it foo.java. It doesn't care at all. Okay? So these are names that people, applications use to access resources. Okay? Internally, there has to be a mapping from names to resources. Okay? And that is essentially the problem of naming. Okay? What is the system that you are going to use to map a name, a string, to a particular resource? What will you use to do this? Okay, we already talked about things like a lookup service or a directory service. Okay, those are also referred to as name services, because they provide a service that allows you to map a string to a particular resource. Okay. So as is mentioned here, names are used to share resources and uniquely identify resources. They may also refer to location. Okay. Another examples are URLs. Okay. So if you say www.cnn.com, that's the name of a server. Okay. What happens internally is this name gets mapped to an IP address. Okay. And your browser actually contacts the server that is listening on to port 80 on that IP address. Okay. From a user perspective, you don't have to remember that www.cnn.com had a numeric IP address. That's much harder for you to remember. So you have been given a much easier to remember string, and the system does the hard work to figure, locate the server for you that corresponds to that name. Okay. So essentially what we are going to look at here is what are naming systems, and more importantly for us, what naming systems work for distributed systems. Okay. So that's basically the goal that we have. And as you will see, as the size of the naming system itself starts increasing, the naming system itself becomes distributed. The directory service itself can become distributed in order to scale to very large systems of distributed entities. So we'll start simple. So here are sort of two canonical approaches that we are going to look at. Okay. Typically, your names could be arranged in a hierarchical fashion. Okay, www.cnn.com, or file names start from a root directory saying root slash something something. So those are hierarchical names. Okay? And you can use a hierarchical naming system to resolve that name and map it to a unique resource. That's a hierarchical naming system as shown here. Okay? Yet another naming system that we will also look at, okay, is what is referred to as a peer-to-peer system. So you have seen this already in the context of CORD. Okay, when we talked about peer-to-peer systems earlier. So if you remember, peer-to-peer systems also provide you a lookup service. You are specifying a name and it gives you a value. So you do key value lookups. Okay. This is essentially the same service that any other naming system provides. Okay. You specify a string, it gives you an IP address. Specify a file name, it tells you where on this file is located. Okay. So all naming services are essentially lookup services. So the point being made here is you can actually implement many of the naming systems that we are going to look at, either using a peer-to-peer implementation or using a hierarchical implementation. Okay. So both of these are available. Today we are only going to focus on this. Okay. But do keep this in mind, because you can actually use this completely different decentralized implementation to implement the same naming service. Okay. So with that in mind, let's just start talking about naming. So the simplest thing that we are already familiar with are file names. Okay. So what the file names do is basically they allow you to specify what is called a hierarchical namespace. So there is a structure that you see in your file system. Okay, this is a hierarchical namespace starting with the root directory. The root directory may have some subdirectories. Subdirectories may have yet other subdirectories. And at the leaves of this tree are individual files. Okay, so here is an example. So this is slash and this is slash keys. Okay, that's basically the file name there. Here you have slash home, slash teen, slash mailbox. So this node basically has this name, okay? Slash home teen mailbox. That's the name of this node. Okay, this node has name slash home slash teen slash twmrc. Okay? So each node in this hierarchy has a particular name, and the name of a node is basically the name of all of its ancestors, okay? And the name of that node itself. Okay? This is how your file system is organized. I mean, conceptually, that's what you do. You start from the root partition and then you sort of traverse down your file system tree until you go into the right directory, and then you access files in that directory. Okay? It's a hierarchical namespace. Yes?
So link from N4 to N5 is symbolic
then? Okay. Question about a link from N4 to N5. In this case, it's a symbolic link. I didn't talk about hard links, soft links, and so on. This is referred to as a soft link. There's a... particular property that the file system imposes is that this be a directed acyclic graph. It looks like a tree, but it's not really a tree, because you can have links going from arrows going from some nodes to some other nodes, which are basically also referred to as links. But what you want is to prevent cycles in the graph. Okay. So it's, as a result, it has to be a DAG, it has to be acyclic. Okay. Why should you not have cycles in a graph, in your file system structure? What's the problem that you will see if there are cycles? You cannot help identifying particular file uniquely. True. But in any case, you can have multiple names for a file as is shown here. So because of this link, this node actually has two names. One name is slash keys. The same file can be accessed as slash home slash teen key. So that's why there are two strings being attached here. So we'll take it as a given that file names may have aliases. Okay? So this is actually an alias for that name. That's actually the real name. That's an alias for that file. Okay? So nodes may have multiple names. You can refer to that node by either of those two names and they'll still map. So it's a many to one mapping. Okay? But each name maps onto a unique node, but a node may have multiple names. So that is true, that you will have multiple names. But then what? What happens if there's a cycle?
There will be multiple paths.
Yes. Yes. So if you have cycles, as was pointed out, doing name resolution is problem. Lots of programs are going to end up having trouble. Okay. So think of a backup program. Okay. Let's say you want to backup all files on your machine. So you start from the root directory, saying let's back up all the files, and then maybe there are two subdirectories. You go into each, back up all the files, and so on. But at some point on, let's say there's a cycle, and a cycle essentially means a node has a link that goes to one of its ancestors. That's going to create a cycle. So if this node actually had an arrow that went up here, then you basically have a loop or a cycle. So this the backup program is basically going to be stuck in this infinite loop. It's never going to end. Terminate, because it will say, okay, what are all the subdirectories here, and you will see a link going here. So it will go back up and start doing the same thing over and over again. Okay, so you will never be able to terminate certain programs or resolve certain names if you have cycles. And this is why you will not be able to create a cycle. If you actually try to create one, the file system will not allow it. It will complain. So that's sort of an aside. That's not directly relevant to the naming issue. But anyway, so let's now look at naming in a distributed system. So here, if you actually, this was just your local disk. Okay, so you say, I want to access this file, and you say slash home slash teen slash mailbox. Your file system has to actually resolve this name. So there's a name lookup that your file system performs. Starts from the root. It parses this string. Starts from the root, and it looks for a subdirectory called home, and it sees one here. Then it goes here, and then it looks for a subdirectory called steam, so it basically goes, descends down here, and then it says, is there a file called mbox, and it does find one, and then it locates that file. Okay. This is how name lookups are going to work on a local file system. Okay. Now what we are really interested in are distributed file systems. So here is what will happen if you try to do name lookups on a remote file. Okay, so let's assume you have something like NFS, okay, network file system. What NFS allows you to do is it takes some files on a machine and it allows them to be accessed from some other machine. Okay? And you have something called a mount protocol, which we will look at later on in this course, that allows you to take an entire subtree here and mount it here. So this entire subtree becomes available here. Okay? And as far as naming is concerned, you now access these files, these remote files, using local names. Okay? Because they just become a subtree in your local hierarchy. Yeah, depending on where you mount that subtree, it just becomes an extension of your local file system. Except that those files are not local, they logically appear in this hierarchy, physically they are on a different node. Okay. So now if you try to do a remote lookup, okay, what's going to happen is here is basically a path. Okay, so you will basically say slash remote slash VU home steen mailbox. So that home steen mailbox is basically still here. It just mounted that home directory on this local workstation. Okay. In the remote slash remote VU part of your file tree. So your file system will still start doing lookup from the root. Okay, so it will start saying slash remote slash VU, it will arrive here, and then it will see there is still a string that it has to resolve, but it also sees that now this subtree here is a logical subtree, it's actually an NFS mount. So it will take, strip off the rest of the string and send it on to the server for resolution. Okay, saying I want this file, so it's basically slash home slash team that's mounted from your server. So then the server has to then resolve the rest of the name and send it back here. Okay. So what has essentially happened is your naming has gotten distributed. Okay. Your name service here is not able to resolve the full name. It has only resolved part of the name. It has sent off the rest of the request off to a different machine to do lookup. So this is the simplest example of a distributed naming system. Yeah, because this is basically motivating why you even need your name system to be distributed. Not all resources may be local, so you can only do some things locally, and then the rest of the resolution has to be done on another node. Is that clear? Okay. So there are some details here about there's a mount table with these mappings that tells it which parts of the subtree are mounted from which machines and so on. When we do our case study on NFS, we will actually come back to all of this and we'll look at this in a lot more detail. But as far as this class is concerned today, we are only interested in the name resolution aspect. The point here is name resolution itself is distributed in NFS. So now let's assume or take it as a given that certain naming systems are going to be distributed. The question is, how do you design a distributed naming system? That's really what is of interest here. And the design of that naming system will actually depend on what is the application, okay? What is the thing that you are trying to use it for. Okay? Certain namespaces may be global in scope. Okay, so the naming scheme also has to be global in scope. Simplest example is URLs. Okay, since you can refer to a URL that refers to an arbitrary machine somewhere on the internet, the naming system that's used in the internet has to be by definition distributed. Okay? So in this case, you will use a DNS or domain name system, which is really a highly decentralized system, okay, that's globally distributed. So if the system is global in scope, your naming system is also going to be highly distributed and global in scope. If you have a much smaller system that's restricted to a local organization, then you may have a distributed system, but it's much smaller. Okay, so for instance, if you have directory services like LDAP or X.500, which we are going to talk about also in this class, you will see that those are also distributed, but not in the same fashion. Okay, so it depends really on the scope of the system. But regardless, in most of these cases, your namespace is going to be organized hierarchically. Very similar to the file system naming example. Okay, there's going to be hierarchical naming. Okay? And typically there will be multiple layers in your naming system. There's something called a global layer, which are the sort of the root nodes of your naming system. There's administrative layer and managerial layer. So let me show you an example of this in the context of the DNS system. Okay? So here is basically how DNS is organized. So there are top level domains. There's .com and .edu, .gov. There's one for each country. Okay? These are referred to as top level domains. Okay? That is also what's called the global layer. Okay? Nodes at this layer don't change frequently. It's not like an everyday thing that new top level domains are introduced. Once in a while, new domains may get approved. Okay? But at that point, new nodes get added to the top level. In most cases, that is static. So the next layer is basically what's called the administrative layer. So these are individual organizations. In .com, you may have like sun.com or any company. Okay? .edu, you have universities and so on. Okay? That's your administrative layer. Okay? If you go one layer down, then you have departments or subunits within that organization. Okay? CS, so you have, let's say, EDU and UMass. So UMass.edu is your organization, and then within that you may have CS and you may have engineering and other organizations. So these are individual departments. Okay? And within departments, you have machines. Okay? So www is a machine that refers to the web server in the cs.umass.edu domain. Okay. mail.cs.umass.edu is another machine that provides the mail service. Okay. So leaves in the DNS refer to individual machine. But there are these other layers. There's the global layer, administrative layer, and the managerial layer. So individual machines are at the managerial layer. So if you see, as you go down this tree, there are most changes occur at the leaves. Okay. Machines come and go. Okay. New machines are brought in, they get their own name, old machines are retired, so the DNS keeps changing most at this managerial layer. Okay. And organizations also come and go, but at a much lower frequency. It is not as frequent as machines coming and going. Okay. New domains may get created, and they get created all the time, but the frequency of changes here is much smaller than the frequency of changes. And as I said, at the top level also there are changes, but they are the least frequent. So this DNS example also illustrates how any other hierarchical namespace is designed. Okay? Typically there will be these three layers, global, administrative and managerial, and the assumption is those are root level nodes, they don't change frequently. These are sort of units within that root level node, they change less frequently, and then at the leaves you have individual resources that can come and go very frequently. Okay, so basically this is just saying the scale of the network, the number of nodes and so on. So I already mentioned most of this. The only thing I didn't mention is replication and caching. So you may actually have replication with your naming system, and you may also have caching. I'll illustrate this in the context of DNS, okay, as we talk a little more about DNS. So let's just take DNS as our example for understanding how to design a global distributed namespace, okay, because it already exists, and using that case study also illustrates how you can build any other global naming system. Okay. So these are basically the types of entries you can have within a DNS system. Okay. What happens in that is, as I said, it's basically a directory lookup. Okay. So the DNS system essentially is a large list of records, and the records refer to individual machines. Okay, in this system. So there are different types of records you can actually have. Okay. The simplest one is what is called an A record. Okay. This actually maps a name to an IP address. Okay. And any A record will basically contain the IP address of that host. Okay. But there are many other types of records. In particular, you can have a CNAME record that's an alias for that machine. Okay. The same machine can have multiple names. So typically when you have something like www.cs.umass.edu, this www usually is an alias. Okay? You will actually have a machine which may have some name, but you advertise it as www because that's the easiest to understand. Okay? Rather than giving some arbitrary name, nobody will be able to remember that. You make it an alias. mail.cs.umass.edu. Again, mail would be an alias for some machine that provides mail. So these are much easier to understand aliases. Okay. And there are several other. There's an MX record. This typically tells you that if there's a mail that is coming to this machine, what's the mail server within that organization that's going to handle mail. Typically for every machine, you may also define an MX record saying any mail here, just send it to the mail server. That will take care of it. Okay, that's called an MX record. There's an NS record which refers to what is the domain name service or the system that provides a DNS service locally within that organization. And there are various other H info and text. And I'll show some examples of these. Okay. Now, before I actually provide show example, let me just talk about how name resolution is going to take place within any distributed naming system. There are two canonical techniques, iterative and hierarchical. In the iterative, what you do is the client name resolver that wants to do this name resolution is going to actually talk to individual name servers as it descends down the hierarchy until it finds the machine it wants. So for instance, let's say you want to resolve this name, ftp.cs.vu.nl. NL is Netherlands, it's a university, it's a computer science department there, this is the FTP server. One way by which you can resolve that name at the client end is iterative as is shown here. So you basically first try to locate the name server for the country. So you send a request to the name server and say, okay, where is the name server for Netherlands, you get that. Okay. And then you basically go to that name server and say, where do I find the name server for that university? Okay. And then that name server is going to say, go and talk to this machine that provides DNS service for that university. Okay. Then you go to the university name server and say, where is the name server for this department? Okay. And then basically you send, so you have basically want to resolve this part of the name is still not resolved, cs.ftp. You go to the name server, it gives you basically the CS name server, which is here. Okay. Then finally you go to the CS name server and say, what's the IP address of this machine that has the name FTP? So you go there and it actually gives you the IP address. Okay. So this is iterative, where each level you basically talk to the name server from the client end, and the client basically tells you, points you to the next level server, and you iterate until you descend down the tree and you hit the leaf node. The other way to do this is recursive, where the client is not going to keep on talking to the name server, but it sends one request to the root and the request keeps trickling down until it actually hits the leaf. So here you basically just send the first request saying, I want to resolve ftp.cs.vu.nl. You send it to the root name server. The root name server says, what's the next level name server that I can forward this to? And it does that. So the step two, it sends that here and says, go and resolve the rest of this name. vu.cs.ftp. So it comes here. Okay. And this name server says, okay, what is the next name server? Sends it to the department one. So you go into cs.ftp. It comes here. And you basically track down the name. And then the response trickles back when you go back to the client. Okay. This is referred to as recursive. So in this case, much of the work is actually happening within the naming system. The client has just injected one request at the root, and that request is processed by the naming system and one response is returned. In the previous case, partial results are returned at each point, and it's the job of the client to do the rest remainder of the resolution. Okay? Any questions on this? So these are two canonical approaches, okay, that you can implement in any global naming system that's hierarchical. Okay, either you do iterative resolution or you do recursive resolution. So this I already mentioned, how you go about doing this. So here are basically some issues in how long it can take to do iterative versus recursive. Okay. So if you are actually trying to resolve a name of a system that is located far away from you, iterative name resolution will require lots of these round-trip delays. It will incur lots of these round-trip delays. But every time you basically, in this case, you are trying to resolve a name of a machine that's located in Europe. Maybe you are doing this from continental US. So every time you do a transatlantic hop, go to the next level name server, so there's going to be a built-in latency of these multiple round-trip delays before you get to the final name. In recursive, you are going to just send one request, and this is going to trickle down to machines that are within that country, and presumably they are located geographically closer, and the hop there is going to be much smaller than doing a transatlantic hop. Okay. So this might resolve faster because there are only two transatlantic hops and all the other hops are local. Okay. In the iterative, you will actually do these multiple round trip hops. Okay. So that's one advantage of doing recursive versus doing iterative. But the disadvantage in doing recursive is there's a lot more load on the naming system itself. Every request is going to start at the root. Okay. So root level servers are going to be very heavily loaded because every request is going through them. Okay. So think of anybody is trying to resolve some foo.com, whatever this foo be, it will always start at the .com server. So this server is going to be flooded with lots and lots of requests. Okay. In an iterative name server service, you can actually employ caching. So once you have resolved the name server for .com, okay, or let's say you basically resolved the name server for VU, which is that university name server, next time instead of FTP you want to look up www, you don't have to start at the top. You could have cached that response from the previous lookup and just talk directly to that server because you have cached the entry. You can't do this in recursive. There is no caching because everything has to be injected at the top and you will actually trickle down to the bottom. Okay? So iterative name service, iterative name resolution rather, allows you to take benefits of caching. Okay? If you have already resolved that organizational level name service before, you can talk directly to it. So you don't have to keep start at the top again. So that will reduce the burden on top level servers, which you will not be able to do in case of recursive. So there is a trade-off. In one case, you might actually have multiple round-trip delays, but you get the benefit of caching, which you don't get in the other. Okay, so there are these trade-offs that you have to keep in mind.
Doesn't your DNS request first go to your ISP DNS, which is not able to be resolved in the local machine, before going to the actual name
server? Right. So what happens typically is you will have a local name service, local DNS server, that your machine is asked to talk to. In this case, this client is not the client machine, although it logically looks like the client machine. It's a client-side DNS server that's doing all of this work for you. It's not your application. Your browser is not doing all this. The browser is always going to go to the local DNS saying, I want to resolve this, do it and send me back the results. If there's already the entry is cached, you don't even have to do anything. You just send back a result. But if not, if partial entries are cached, you can start from the point and go down. Okay, that's how things work. Any questions here? Okay, so here are some examples of DNS records. I'm going to show some real ones also just in a moment. But all I wanted to point out is all these types of records that I mentioned. So whenever you have an A record, you have a string and you have an IP address. Okay, that just says this machine has that IP address. Whenever you have an MX record, you are basically say that's the mail server for this machine. If you send any mail to user at this string, your DNS will actually tell your mail client to send that to this machine. Okay? You can specify multiple mail servers as has been done there with different priority levels, priority 1 and priority 10, which also says if one is down, you can go to the other, start with the highest priority one, that's the first one you contact. If that doesn't respond, you go down. So you have all these built-in mechanisms to do all of that. The text field basically just describes the organization. So here is a text field, it says that's the organization. Okay. So you can have all of these types of entries in there. So here is an alias that I was mentioning. So this is the machine that actually provides the web service or the web runs the web server, and it has an alias called www. So this is how you can actually get to that. Okay. This is essentially an example from the author's own department, but I'll show some real ones. Okay, is this clear, what I just showed you? So let's just do some. So there is a way for which you can actually do DNS lookups yourselves instead of your browser doing this. So typically, you can use this call called host and specify some name. So here is So here is the resolution for www.cs.umass.edu. So it returned that there is an IP address. It also returned an MX record saying mail is handled by that machine. Okay, that's basically the mail server that will respond if you send mail to this machine. You can actually do a verbose version which will show you some other information. Okay, so if you do the verbose version, it also shows you what name services actually can respond to that entry. Okay. So here is this is the NS record. This says these are the name service. So here is the CSDNS name service, unix1.cs.umass.edu. There's another one that also acts as a replica for CS, that's the engineering name server, that's ecs.umass.edu. These are the three name servers at the UMass level. These are organizational level name servers, ns1.umass.edu 2, 3. So these are all machines that can actually respond to any request for these, because they are allowed to cache. So that's what this more verbose version is showing you. This is actually showing you the IP addresses of these name DNS look servers. So when you do this resolution, you'll say this is the next level and that's the IP address. So then you have to actually go and ask that if you are doing iterative name service resolution. Your question is, what command was that? So that, I mean, this is only going to work on Unix machine. So you can either use this thing called host, or there's one called dig. There used to be one called nslookup, which I think doesn't work anymore. It's been deprecated. So you can do dig, which will tell you the same thing. Actually, 1G, not 2. So here are some, I'm just going to show two more examples and then we will wrap up. So let's just do cnn.com. Okay. So you dissolved cnn.com and 6 entries came back. So it says this address, this. Okay, now you can do it again. And you show again 6 entries came back, but the top entry, the order in which the entries have been returned to you, has changed. Okay. Now this is referred to as round robin DNS. So you, in DNS, you can have the same name map onto multiple machines if that service is replicated on these multiple machines. So what has happened here is the CNN web server is replicated on all of these machines. So in the DNS, you've actually put all of those entries, and the DNS service will then return these entries to you in a different order for different lookups. This does automatic load balancing. So what a browser will do is, typically it will just take the first response and just ignore the rest and talk to the machine there. So if different browsers are given different IP addresses as a top level one, different browsers will contact different replicas. The load that's coming into the system will automatically get distributed across this multiple address. So every time you do a lookup, it will return it in a different order. So now the 26th one appeared here, for instance. So you can actually use DNS to replicate your service and automatically load balance using this mechanism, because different clients will talk to different IP addresses depending on which is the first one that was returned. Okay, I'll show you another interesting thing and then we'll wrap up for today. So let's resolve intel.com. So it says intel.com is an alias for something, that's an alias for something else. So multiple levels of aliases have to be resolved. So this is an alias. So this CNAME record, it is saying that's an alias for that, that's an alias. So after following 4 aliases, what you have is this machine actually maps to this, and that has an IP address 128.119.66.134. Okay. That's actually a UMass IP address. 128.119 is UMass subnet. So what has actually happened is your intel.com is mapping to some machine that's inside the UMass domain. Now the reason this is happening is there is this web service is employing caching. So it is actually employing cache that has been deployed by this other organization called Akamai. And they have deployed caches everywhere. So what this is telling you is, if you want to access that web page, all you have to do is go and talk to your local cache. And if it has cached it, then all of the pages that are stored on intel.com are also cached here. Okay? And you will just get an entry directly from your local machine here. Okay? This will improve the speed of your response. Okay? So if you actually have when we talk about content distribution network, we'll see that there are networks that have deployed thousands of caches of web pages everywhere. Okay? So when you try to resolve any name where that service has actually employed that caching mechanism, then that resolves to something that is very close to you in order to improve the latency that you use to access this bit. Now, any service that is actually using this Akamai's web caching service will map, in this case, to your closest node. So it has intelligence. It's saying, where is this lookup coming from? It knows it's coming from UMass. It's saying, where is the cache that is closest to this machine? It says, there's one right in the organization. So it is going to do this. If you go home and you do the same lookup from your broadband, let's say your Comcast or some such thing, you'll get a different IP address. That will be another cache that's within the Comcast network, presumably, and close by to you. So the same name can resolve to arbitrary machines or arbitrary caches depending on the location from where the lookup is coming from. So what this also shows is that the naming system actually can embed intelligence to see where are the requests coming from. Essentially, this is a replica. Let's say, where is the closest replica? It's a cache replica. And so let me just resolve that to the closest one. The CNN one, they're all probably located in CNN's data center. They're not distributed. It's just cycling through them. Here, they're distributed globally. And it's just mapping you to the closest one. So you can use naming schemes to do things like this. Okay, so that's basically all I wanted to say. We've run out of time, so let's just stop for the day here.